the speech he made up at the Ketchikan High School. He was talking about the mercury in the halibut and what they were trying to do with the halibut. And he says, well, you know, if you hang the halibut long enough upside down, you can just cut the head off. That got the attention of the people in the community. But he worked very hard for 38 years, as said, and I don't know how he could do it. I couldn't make it that long, as you all know. But I would appreciate all of your support in moving the bill on today. And if there's anything I can answer, I'll certainly try.
That voice sounds awful familiar.
Yes, it does sound familiar. Bill, thank you for that testimony, and it is good to hear your voice again. You are definitely missed here, and hope you'll visit us one of these days. For the record, we have Representative Croft and Representative Warrock and Representative Holm have joined us. I think we have some questions for you.
All right.
Representative Warrock.
Hi, Bill.
How you doing there, sir?
Hi, thank you. I was curious, is this a trail or a bike path?
It's a bike path. It's about 6 feet wide and follows the South Tongass Highway.
Should it be the Joe Williams Coastal Bike Path?
Yes, it could be if you get the bill moving on.
Anything else, Representative Warrock? Anything else for Representative Williams, former Representative Williams? Okay, Bill, well, call back again, all right?
I will. Thank you very much. And it's, I don't miss the work that you guys are doing, but I do miss your friendship that I made up there, and good luck this year.
All right. Thank you, Bill. All right, Bill, is your brother there still, Joe?
Yeah, Joe Williams Jr. Just in speaking for a small community of Saxmen, would truly be a great honor, at least to our small community, and actually the Native community in the greater Ketchikan area, to have a trail named after my father. That truly would be an honor, and certainly support it 100%. That's all I have.
All right, Joe. Well, we appreciate you being brief. You obviously didn't get that from your brother, Bill.
Well, he is 2 years older than me.
Yeah, I know.
And he's always been 2 years older than me.
And always will be, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, thanks for your testimony. Let's see, is Y.B. Hicks there?
It's Yede. Thanks a lot.
Yede. Okay, sorry.
As I testified at the last hearing, my reason for seeing this path named after Joe Williams Sr. is more selfish. I work with the kids in this village of Saxman, and I see that naming this path after Joe Williams is a source of pride. And I'm always looking for sources of pride for Native youth in this community. And it's more than a bike path. It's like someone said, the elders used to walk this path a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I still see them today exercising their hearts as they walk the bike path now. And I really think it'd be an honor for the entire community to have this name after Joe Williams Sr. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Is Frank Saluto there?
Hi, I'm Vice Mayor of Saxman, and I also support this 100% because it's he's done a lot of great work in the community of Ketchikan, and you know you always hear stories about him, about Joe, and all his works that he's done. So I also support this 100%. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in Ketchikan that still wanted to testify on this bill?
No one here but the four of us.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Is there anybody in the audience that wanted to testify? Okay. Seeing none. Okay. We already know the fiscal note's been zeroed out. So let's see. Anything else come for us on this particular bill? If not, Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I go ahead and move HB 42 out of committee within the legal recommendations with the attachments tomorrow.
Any objections? Seeing none, that is done. Thank you, Bill, and the rest of you there at Ketchikan for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, while we're signing the sheet here, let's go ahead and get the next presenters forward. Let's see. This is House Bill 102, Foreign Medical School Graduates.
Chairman,
Representative Stoltz.
Mr. Chairman, the Commission of Committee, and Mr. Mulligan from my staff present this bill. Not as many people are mad at him as they are me. So.
I was going to say, we'd rather throw darts at you, but that's fine if that's... That's your wish. Okay, Mr. Mulligan, for the record, if you'll state your name. And
my name is Ben Mulligan, staff representative Bill Stoltz. The overall purpose for House Bill 102 is to alleviate a known shortage of physicians in Alaska. Currently, we are ranked 46th in the nation as far as physicians per 100,000 people. What this legislation will allow is, at the discretion of the Alaska State Medical Board, individuals that have graduated from a foreign medical school to practice medicine here in Alaska. Right now, the only stipulation is a two-year U.S. Graduate Medical Education Program, or residency. The legislation is intended to alleviate the shortage, but in no way is it meant to make it easier to practice medicine here in Alaska. We believe the State Medical Board will apply the same, strict and rigorous guidelines for people graduating from medical schools here in the States as they would for foreign medical students. The last section, Section 3, just provides some recommended guidelines for these discretions from the board. If there is any questions.
Any questions? Okay, Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might, I see we've got support from the Alaska State Medical Association, which is laudatory. Have you run this by either Providence or Regional Hospital for thoughts on the bill?
Can I jump in?
Sure, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chenault. Chairman Meyer, Representative Parker. I didn't run it by the hospital itself, but there one of their representatives here, Ms. Herman. I talked about it in the hallway and got a thumbs up on it. But I would never represent their position here, but that's my informal conversations with them.
Thank you.
Anything else, Representative Parker?
No, sir.
Okay, Representative
Wire. Mr. Mulligan, what is the definition of an active medical practice in Section 3?
Through the chair, Representative Firebach. Right now, I do not know that. I can check on that, or we do have Jim Jordan, the executive director for the Alaska State Medical Association, online, and he may know the answer to your question.
Yeah, maybe Mr. Jordan would. Active medical practice. The other thing is the under Section 3B2, the current board certification in a practice, especially by the American Board of Medical Specialties. What about, Ms. Mulligan, if there's a general practitioner? Is that a specialty, if there's someone who's a general practitioner, a family practitioner, or a general surgeon? Is that a board-certified practice specialty if somebody's generic?
That wouldn't fall, through the chair of the environment, that would not fall under American Board of Medical Specialties. I believe that would just fall under the Alaska Medical, or American Medical Board. But I can check on that for specifics.
Because, Mr. Chairman, if someone does not have a current board certification in a specialty, but they have a long practice of general medicine, which is many times the kind of medical qualification needed in the Bush area, would that exclude that person from being able to practice under this bill?
Through the chair, these stipulations in Section 3 are just guidelines for the board. They may or may not adopt these stipulations, as under the language says may include. They may or may not decide that is a worthy requirement and decide on another guideline.
I'm just curious why, of all the things that they may include, why these two are why these are set out, of all the hundreds of potential requirement factors that it could include.
Through the chair, one of the, for B, subsection 2, one of the specifics is medical specialties. In some cases, from data in Anchorage itself, there may be only 2 to 3 physicians who practice a specialty, as in oncology, allergy medicine, and stuff like that. So that's reason for one of those, is just to recognize that we're looking at specialties, trying to fill the vacancy for specific medical practice.
All right. Finally, Mr. Chairman, recognized hospital, why are these two entities the ones named in this bill in Section 3, the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada?
Through the chair, that I do not know at this time, but I can check on that for you. Or Mr. Jordan may know that also.
You know, Mr. Representative Roderick, we do have several people online to testify, and some of these questions may be answered.
That's great.
So if you want to just...
I've got them out there.
Okay. Very good. Anything else you want to get out there? That's it. All right. Representative Crock.
I'll put those in the same category. Maybe I'll listen to the other people and see if they answer. Okay.
Very good. We'll go ahead and go to the... we'll go online. Let's see. We also have Rick Urey in the audience. Did you want to testify, sir? Okay. Why don't you come on up? And then we'll go to teleconference where we have Jim Jordan, Director of Alaska State Medical Association, and George Stewart, doctor. Rick, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urey. I'm the Director of Division of Occupational Licensing. I'm here today to testify enthusiastically in favor of the bill that's before you. One of the problems I have discovered in my tenure as Director of Division of Occupational Licensing is our licensing laws are written in such a way, in black and white, and leave no discretion for making any exceptions, and life is just not black and white. And we could solve a lot of problems if we were given a little discretion. And this bill before you solves that problem with the medical community, and I think it gives the board the discretion to make some changes or some... make some choices there that will certainly protect the public, and it's not going to open up practice of medicine to those people who are graduate from diploma mills or medical schools of questionable validity. This is legitimate stuff, and I think it's very important that you pass this bill before you. I think you'll hear about some classic cases of people that we've missed out on being able to practice in the state because of the way our law is written. And I'd ask that you pass the bill before you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from Mr. Geary? Question,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly. Maybe this is appropriate for Mr. Geary. Since these people that we're talking about are kind of coming over the fence, new to our country, we've got background checks and those sorts of things in place that if they'd matriculated in the U.S., it might not be such a hard to check thing. But if we got something that corresponds to a solid background checks and making sure that that everything's squared away in that arena.
Through the chair, I think you'll find that most of the people that we're talking about that are going to qualify for this are living within the United States today. Okay. And they've been here for years and years and years. Okay. And have lots of experience. So I don't think there's any issue that you mentioned is a problem at all. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Keller. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go ahead and go online now to Jim Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Jim Jordan. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association. And as was mentioned earlier, we had previously provided written testimony, and I won't delve into that directly. And I'll hopefully have more time to answer some of the questions that have already been posed and some that you probably will have. But just again to reiterate, the Alaska State Medical Association strongly supports HB 102 as another tool to help us recruit the physicians and the numbers, and particularly the well-trained physicians and the numbers that we need. I would also like to mention, because there was a question about physician shortages earlier in the hospital's interest in the issue, Providence Medical System did a study in 2002 that showed at that time their service area, which is primarily the Anchorage Bowl, there were 200 physicians short at that time. They have refreshed that study. It is still under finalization. However, the preliminary numbers show that that 200 number is staying about the same as far as the shortage here. And if you extrapolate that and move it forward into 2009, it moves up closer to 260 to 270 physicians short. And if you wish to extrapolate that statewide, our extrapolation would leave the numbers in the area of 450 to 500 physicians short at this point in time. So we feel that this is a very necessary tool. And if I may just jump to answering a few of these questions, and then I'll answer any others that you might have. First of all, the question came about what does actively practicing mean? That's a term of art that and what I would see the intent is to make sure that the physicians that you are looking at these alternate competency guidelines for are physicians that are currently practicing, actually seeing patients, and in the medical world, actively practicing means that they're actively seeing patients. And the other question that came about had to do with the whether or not general practice would fall under a specialty type of certification. Yes, there's the American Academy of Family Practitioners, which is specifically a board that recognizes that specialty area. And the one of the reasons why board certification is recognized as a core competency is that essentially in order to get that specialty designation, there's extensive peer review that is done of the physician's practice, just as an example, with actual review of charts and patient treatment. And also, I believe the third question was why the term recognized hospital was being defined, and specifically dealing with the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education or the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. Those are the entities that credential or accredit the graduate medical education programs in the United States and in Canada, respectively. And they go through extensive accreditation procedures for the intern and residency programs, which we lump and call graduate medical education, and which are primarily provided through hospitals. For example, we have one residency program in Alaska, the family practice residency, which comes through the auspices and support of Providence Hospital. So with that, I would be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Professor Weimer, Professor Croft, questions answered? Professor Croft, go ahead.
I guess I wanted to hear the justification for the very broad amount of discretion that this gives. It took me a while in reading it, but it's essentially any proof of competency. I mean, it's at the discretion of the board, and in B, while it gives some examples, there may include an ORS, so you could literally have any requirement that the board adopted by regulation in place of the postgraduate training element. I'm not necessarily averse to it, but I wanted to understand why that broad a discretion is needed.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I guess in my way of thinking that it's my feeling that we have a very professional state medical board, and they are not going to be interested in watering down any credentials. And the way I would view that they would look at this is they would be looking at this in the manner of looking at other alternative measures of competency that would at least be minimally equivalent to what currently is required in that of any licensee up here, and that is the three-year graduate medical education requirement. And, you know, for example, there's a whole host of competency requirements that come to mind. One that is brand new, that, and I don't know whether they would adopt this or not, but it wouldn't surprise me, but right now, all physicians coming out of school need to pass a core clinical competency exam and in order to practice, and it wouldn't surprise me to have that as one.
Thank you, Mr. Jake.
All right, any other questions for Mr. Jordan? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. We'll move on then to Dr. Stewart.
Yes, good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to comment on this very, very important piece of legislation. I've been practicing here in Anchorage since 1971. I'm a specialist in the areas of lung disease and critical care medicine. I was actually the first trained in this area in the state of Alaska in 1971. In my own specialty area, by demographics, we should have 10 in Anchorage, which serves as the tertiary care center for the state of Alaska. Right now we have 8. Two of us, including myself, are 68 years old and probably should have retired years ago, but we can't because of the shortage of care in our specialty area. We do the intensive care and those sorts of things. In Anchorage right now, we have a shortage, as I said, in my own specialty area. We have a shortage in internal medicine. We have a shortage in endocrinology and neurology and rheumatology, and there are other specialties as well. The purpose of this legislation is not to lower the bar. The purpose is not to lower the standards, not to allow people from diploma mills to come to the state of Alaska and hazard the care of our people. The purpose is to allow the board discretion to license physicians who are superbly qualified, well qualified, but don't meet the exact letter of the present regulation, which is 3 years of training in the United States. For instance, and I'll give you a concrete example, this is a physician who desperately wanted to come to Alaska, loved Alaska. He is practicing in the state of Colorado right now. He happens to be from Venezuela. He was fully trained in Venezuela in internal medicine and in critical care, and as a matter of fact was director of the critical care unit at the University Hospital in Caracas. He decided to move to the United States 12 years ago. He has practiced in the United States for 12 years. He did a three-month fellowship at Ann Arbor in the burn unit and a two-year fellowship at the University of Texas in adult and pediatric pulmonary disease. He is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Colorado, but he didn't qualify for an Alaska license. We applied twice to see if we could get some way around the existing legislation, or the existing regulation, rather. But since he had only had 27 months of training in the United States and not 36, Wilmer Perez did not qualify for an Alaska license, and as a result, we had a shortfall of critical care specialists that was made worse in Anchorage and in the state of Alaska. And as a matter of fact, his wife was a pediatrician who would have come to Alaska to practice as well. That's a concrete example. A theoretical example, a physician by the name of Derek Angus, who is from Scotland, who trained at Edinburgh, who received his pulmonary training and critical care training at the Brompton Hospital in London, which is one of the most renowned pulmonary specialty hospitals in the world. He came to the United States on a research fellowship, fell in love with the United States, loved Pittsburgh where he was on his research fellowship, rose through the ranks. He is now professor of medicine, pulmonary medicine, critical care medicine, and preventive medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. He is director of the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Pittsburgh, as well as their healthcare policy division. But he would not qualify for an Alaska license if he decided to come here because he's had no training in the United States, and yet he is board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary disease, critical care, and sleep medicine. And by the way, let me go back to Wilmer Perez for a moment and say that he is board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary disease, and critical care. the present law, the present regulation, as it's interpreted, is really denying care to Alaska citizens. So if I may strongly support House Bill 102, and if there are any questions, I'm available.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any questions for the
Chairman Meyer, I'd just like to, I met Dr. Stewart for the first time, although he has cared for both of my parents very ably, but at the previous hearings, the first time I met him. But I guess I will ask him, it's, I've learned a little about specialty medicine because of a malady I have, and the endocrinologist I visit has a 3 to 6 month waiting period for appointments. Is that typical in some of these specialty fields, even in the major markets like Anchorage?
Yes, it is. There are only 3 endocrinologists in Anchorage, as you're aware of. And yes, the intake time for a new patient into those 3 practices can be as long as 6 months. Right now in the area of rheumatology, because of a tragic death earlier this fall, we have one in the specializing in the area of rheumatology, which covers a lot of the immune deficiencies and other things. So, yes, the typical wait period, for instance, in my office is 3 months for a new patient.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative. Okay, seeing no other questions. Thank you, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you.
And let's see, for the record, Representative Jewell has been with us for a while. Okay, is there any other, anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify on this particular bill? Seeing not, any more discussion? Questions for the sponsor? Representative Robert.
Well, I was going to suggest amendment, but do you want to wait on that?
I think this is the time. Is it a major amendment, Representative Weirach, or is it a minor one?
Depends, I guess.
Because normally we like to see these amendments ahead of time.
It's conceptual. Just small. Not major.
All right, go ahead, Representative Weirach.
Of course, it depends on Representative Stoltz. I was in Section 3 of the bill. I was going to add read and write legibly, but then that would exclude the entire profession. So, as one of the requirements to read and write English, because you want to be able to have people be able to communicate in English and write in English, but I sort of thought the better of it, but I just wondered that it was considered when you...
Go ahead, Representative Phil.
Mr. Chairman, you and Bob Lehner are of a like mind.
Oh, you really?
And if that's any comfort, or... But I'd sure like Mr. Jordan to comment on this.
Mr. Jordan, or Jim Jordan, did you hear Representative Weirach's question?
Yes, I did. And I think that there's probably already protections in place to warrant that, because I think that someone would be hard-pressed to pass the medical boards that they're required to pass without having a fluency in English.
That's good enough for me. The other conceptual amendment I'm not going to offer, I wanted to discuss it first, is in Section C of Section 3. In this section, recognized hospital, replacing the word means with includes. Because it means, it seems to limit it to those two entities as opposed to including those as the entities that may or may not be worthy of consideration as a recognized hospital.
You want to have Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Jordan.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jordan, did you hear Representative Weirach's question as to why we use means instead of includes there?
Yes, I did. I did hear the question, Mr. Chair. And if I may respond, I think that the correct word is means, because the reference to in this section goes back to the original body of the licensing law in dealing with recognized graduate medical programs in the United States. And the only two bodies that accredit and recognize those are these two entities that are listed here.
I make these suggested amendments in way of getting to an answer to a question, not so much to tinker with the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. Thank you, Representative Robert. And Representative Robert, these are rather small amendments or potential amendments, so those are fine. Okay, any other comments? Representative Croft.
I guess I'm still not sure, but that Representative Wyrock's ideas weren't good ones, as much as we're all surprised by that. Why would you want to limit yourself to only those two in a bill that is promoting flexibility? I mean, say the examples you were giving us, if they had come from a hospital outside of North America, I didn't follow all your examples, but a Peruvian hospital that worked, or a British or whatever, why? Because the discretion you gave yourself in B, you're taking away to some extent by such a specific North American definition of recognized hospital. you can have it, I guess, if you'd like it, but I wonder why you'd want to limit yourself to just the North American accreditations, not Europe, not any place else, at the same time giving yourself a broad discretion in the other area.
Okay, we'll go to Mr. Jordan.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Croft, I guess I don't quite interpret it in that manner. The way I see it is that the recognized hospital language that's in there would relate to those foreign medical graduates who have satisfied the three-year graduate medical education requirement in the United States. I think that there's still the latitude is given for those who haven't to the board, who then can, through the regulatory process, for example, there may be a recognized graduate medical program in Scotland, in referencing Dr. Stewart's hypothetical, that may in fact be a great equivalency. But yet the state medical board would have the authority to, in their regulation, to, with specificity, outline that particular program.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't much matter, since A and B are either or. We're defining narrowly the type of hospital that you must have the two additional years of postgraduate training at, and then giving a whole other option that could be anything else. It's odd, but I think it works with the means. I mean, you might have a regulation under B that said a recognized hospital is something else. But if that's the way that the medical board would like it, that's fine.
Cool. Okay, thank you, Representative Croft. Yeah, I think it's, I would agree with the sponsor and Mr. Jordan that it's fine as is, unless somebody does want to make an official amendment for more discussion. Okay, seeing none, then Representative Foster.
Yeah, I'm going to move out HB 102 with individual recommendation for the industrial commitment.
Zero fiscal note, yes. Okay, any objections? Seeing none, bill passes committee. Okay, we'll just take a real brief at ease while we sign the sheet here on the... Okay, Finance Committee is back in order. We now have CS House Bill 115, Transportation before us. This is the airport customer facility charges. And Mr. Appleby, Josh Appleby, will be presenting the bill to us today. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Josh Appleby, staff to Representative Anderson, who was unfortunately waylaid in Anchorage today. I apologize for not being here. But I will provide the opening statements for House Bill 115, sponsored by the Labor and Commerce Committee. House Bill 115 provides a mechanism through customer facility charges, or CFCs, to improve airport facilities without the expenditure of state funds. The most common projects that CFCs are used to fund are car rental facilities. The bill will also provide a revenue stream to maintain and operate the facilities without requiring an increase to the airport operating budget, as the cost of maintenance will be paid by the related customer facility maintenance charge. This bill will implement a valuable private marketing tool to construct improvements to Alaska airports without the expenditure of public funds. This will improve the amenities provided to the traveling public, both Alaskan and non-Alaskan alike. A private industry-initiated project sponsored by the local on-airport car rental companies is in the process of undertaking a very similar project at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. And although the project was delayed by the events of 9/11, it is now moving ahead. During negotiations with the state over the implementation of this project, certain issues were identified with the language that was set forth in law at Chapter 99 SLA 2001, which needed to be clarified to ensure that bonds to build this project were marketable. Those issues essentially revolve around clarifying that the new revenue stream generated by the CFCs would not be considered revenue of the state when the bond is a private initiative, and assuring that the bond trustee, not the state, takes custody of the funds. Without that clarification, we feel that the 2001 language did not adequately clarify that the CFCs were not revenues of the state for the determination of whether they should be subject to pre-existing airport bonds. The definition of what bond-related purposes the CFCs should be applied to will also be clarified to include debt reserve funds and other bond underwriter requirements. House Bill 115 offers new jobs, efficiency, and innovation in the car rental market, a partnership with private enterprise, modernization to compete with airports nationally, and enhanced convenience. And as communities like Anchorage continue to grow, certainly with the added potential of a new convention center, a new car rental facility will be a welcome addition to the vibrant and growing city. We have here today Mr. Mark Pfeffer, coming in from Anchorage, who is available to answer any technical, historical, or practical questions you might have about this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Appleby. We do have a question from Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman, Mr. Appleby. I'm looking at my notes from my staff from previous committees. The Assistant Attorney General that does Department of Transportation legal issues referenced the notes that I said the bill looked fine overall, but there were some technical things that should be looked at before it passed. You know what he was alluding to?
Well, I don't know specifically what he's alluding to through the chair, Representative Stoltz. However, we are working with him to identify those specific areas, and it was certainly don't mean to speak for him, but during the testimony before the Transportation Committee, did not feel that they were substantive enough to hold the bill up.
So that's going to be in here?
I'm sorry, President Flora, do you have?
No,
So, go ahead, President.
Where do those take place? I mean, are you suggesting here? I'm just looking at my notes, and I don't want to turn this to the Judiciary Committee.
Go ahead, President.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly appreciate the sentiments of not becoming like another committee. However, until those changes are specifically fleshed out, I believe that under this title, it's certainly possible to take care of those issues by the time it passes out of the House into the upper body. If they are as not substantive as they claim to be.
Okay, well, perhaps we'll hear...
That was code.
Perhaps we'll hear what these concerns are as we go through the testimony and
I guess we can determine if they're substantive or not. Representative Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you repeat, you read your statement there, something without public funds. Would you repeat what you said?
That's correct. The mechanism that is described in these sections of statute, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Weirach, is the customer facility charges that are passed along to the consumer, in addition to the customer facility maintenance charges, are what will be used to both construct and maintain this facility, and public funds will not be used.
Without public funds. Where does it say that in the bill?
I believe that, Mr. Chairman, that the language in the bill refers to the customer facility charges and won't actually say there won't be any public funds. So we're providing the mechanism so there doesn't have to be.
So would the sponsor have any objection to adding the without public funds into the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that's appropriate within the drafting language, but the sponsor would not object to that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure where this would fit into the bill, but I just wanted to incorporate that intent that it would be the customer and maintenance money that would be used to construct and maintain the facility without the use of public funds.
Okay. Very good. Why don't you hold on to that, and then maybe while we go through the rest of the testimony,
certainly.
You can see for a good place to insert it, or perhaps when you come back,
certainly.
See us to take care of that. Person,
on this point, and I don't know that I can immediately point at the answer, but I believe the answer to your query lies on page 3, line 6, where it refers to, or another third party, if the state on behalf of the department did not incur the indebtedness. So I think we've identified the non-indebtedness, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hawker, for pointing that out. Okay, why don't we go ahead?
Did you have a sponsor with a question?
Okay, go ahead, Representative Stoll.
Mr. Appleby and Chairman Meyer, is it the intent that this is going to apply to international airports? Is that the scope of what you expect this legislation to apply to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoll, the intent of the legislation is certainly to provide it in any area that has a market that can sustain through their customer facility charges the building and maintenance of such a facility.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Appleby, would you have a problem with limiting to that and not applying it to rural airports?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoltz, no, the sponsor doesn't have any objection to that. I guess that would be limiting to any future time where a non-international airport in the state would develop a market that could sustain the construction and maintenance of such a facility. Currently, the only ones in the state, I believe, are international airports. But if you'd like to limit the possibility of, say, any airport in an area that's not international.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's just sometimes I'm parochial and provincial. I happen to just walking distance from the only rural airport that actually makes money in the state and that subsidizes the other ones. And I don't know what it could morph into, and I'm always trying to protect the small business owner tenants, and I'd hate to be down the line 4 or 5 years from now at a public hearing for regulations on something and say, well, Stoltz voted for this bill and gave us the authority to do this. And I know that's not your intent, but I don't want to fall into this. I hope to be here in 4 or 5 years. Have that circumstance. I appreciate the discussion.
Thanks. Representative Weirach.
On that point, Mr. Chairman, is the only airport that would be affected by this the airport in Anchorage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, I believe currently the only market studies and projects that are planned are in Anchorage. I don't know if there has been any studies or plans to do any project like this, say, in Fairbanks?
Well, I mean, it really goes to the title, the airport facility owned or controlled by the state. How many airports are there like that in the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, I don't have that information. I could get that to you as far as numbers go.
follow-up sure. question on sure, a different sure. subject. Why does this exempt the entire process from the Administrative Procedures Act in terms of notice and opportunity to comment? Because the public here would be the one you'd be paying the fee and be paying the increases in the fees, but it exempts the process from notice and opportunity to comment, except for the way it's defined in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, specifically, I would refer that question to Mr. Pfeffer.
Okay, I had another question.
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Appleby, why is it that these 501c3s are exempt from paying rent, but then but it says that the public may not be deprived of equal use of the airport? Is if one entity has to pay a rent, but these other entities don't, is that equal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, I don't know the exact answer to that question.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, the other thing that the Commissioner is going to do in here is periodically adjust the amount of fees and charges to pay for the debt. What is contemplated by periodically?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, that would, of course, depend on the Commissioner and the Department. I think we've given them some latitude so as not to constrain them within a certain time frame.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and take some additional testimony and take questions from the people in the audience. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Appleby, for bringing the bill forward. We have with us today to testify Mark Pfeffer, John Steiner, and no one on the line here. Okay, Mr. Pfeffer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Pfeffer. I'm a representative of Venture Development Group in Anchorage. Our company has contracted individually with each of 7 different rental car companies that operate at Anchorage International Airport. As mentioned in earlier testimony, this project started in year 2000 and was put on hold for about a year and a half during the events of 9/11. So it's been moving along for quite some time. The reason that I am here is the rental car companies worked closely with the airport in Anchorage to try to come up with a private sector solution to the congestion problem for rental cars at Anchorage International Airport, rather than having the airport or Department of Transportation initiate the project. This project would provide for a facility immediately outside the door of Anchorage International Airport, be connected to the airport through the existing but new rail depot tunnel. It would allow customers or passengers to come from the airport through the tunnel under cover protection from weather into a rental car lobby, into this facility, get their rental car, pass out of the facility easily, and then do the reverse on the way back. Once the cars have been returned, the cars would be run through car wash, vacuuming, and fueling facility right in this building, eliminating traffic and trips to and from remote sites. As mentioned, the facility will be paid for by a customer facility charge. There will be no obligation of the state on the bonds. They'd be strictly revenue bonds paid back from revenues collected by this customer facility charge. It's our intent to begin construction this spring. It's one of the reasons that we're here in front of you today is to try to clarify some of the language for the bond issuers and the bond insurers. So that we can do a bond issuance in April, thereby allowing construction. It sounds like you have a lot of questions going through listening to the previous testimony, so I'm going to stop my testimony there and try to answer any questions people may have.
Very good. Yes, I think we do have a few questions for you. Where do you want to start? Why would you want to present some of your questions to?
Just to, so I can conceptualize what you're doing here. Is this a garage to park cars?
At first, we called it a garage. After having worked on it for quite some time, I'm now calling it a terminal because it's really a place where many different people going in different directions meet many different operators of cars. Having said that, it parks 1,400 cars, but they do a pretty complicated circulation dance getting in and out of the facility and through fueling, vacuuming, car washing, etc.
Okay, so this is a rental car facility.
Yes.
With little windows and kiosks and attendant facilities related to bringing back and getting rental cars out, like I'm used to in, say, Seattle.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is there going to be a USO lounge in it or anything related to that?
No, I believe that's going to remain in the Anchorage International
It threw me when I read all this stuff about lounges and militias and nonprofits. What is the point of having that in this bill?
I believe that's language that's in existing legislation, and we're only amending certain sections with relation to the customer facility charge. I'd have to...
Okay. Then... is the same language in existing statute which exempts the notice and comment period from the Administrative Procedures Act?
I can't answer that directly, but I can tell you that on the lines, on page 3, lines 21 through 22, the department, meaning the Department of Transportation, shall provide a public notice and an opportunity to comment before the charge is set. But because of timing issues, viewing this as also a public notice period for the public and trying to exempt the Administrative Procedure Act.
So essentially, since it's going to be revenue bonds, what's going to happen is that the rental car companies are going to have a surcharge on their cars that they rent, and it'll be something like facility charge. The revenues from that will be dumped back into some fund payable to the state, which will then pay for bonding and the construction and maintenance that way?
Very close. The customers will, the car rental companies will collect a charge from the customer. They will remit it to a third-party trustee who will then pay back bondholders, so the funds will never become funds of the state.
And then what is the anticipated cost of the project after you break ground this spring?
All in total cost, $42 million.
And is it going to be a phased project, or are you going to build it all at once?
It'll be all at once.
And when are the bond is sale? Is the bond sale going to be for $42 million?
Yes.
Is it going to be earthquake-proof in advance or afterwards?
In advance. just by way of note, the after the events of 9/11, facilities close to terminals are required to go through a bomb blast test.
Can I come up with that?
And we will be doing that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Representative Barber. Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think I'm going to replow a little bit of the ground, but maybe just a clarification that I think will also answer Representative Stoltz's concerns. Am I correct in understanding the need for this legislative change is really driven by the finance community more than the, you can call it the facilities maintenance people, and that this change is needed so that you can have a customer facility charge that a bond trustee could receive directly without having to be subject to a regular recurring legislative appropriation?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Hawker, that's correct.
And so what that does is then it allows private sector to essentially step in, take on the risk associated with the project with the blessing of course, the owners of the airport and facility. But it wouldn't, and I say representing to respond to Representative Stoltz's concern that say up at Birchwood, the idea here is not the state comes in and finds a way to take money out of the pockets of people working at the airport, using the airport, but the investment group could go to Birchwood, go to the pilots and decide to build a new hangar and support facility and find a way to do it, bond it, run a debt financing that would not then be subject to further constraint by the state that might in fact aid the future development of the Birchwood Airport and benefit the users there.
That's correct. However, I think the opposite is true as well. The state could impose the charge It could go either way. In this case, the state wanted to impose the charge on the cart rental industry at Anchorage International Airport, and the industry said, we don't like your plan, we'd like you to let us give you a proposal, and that's how we ended up here.
Follow up then. And in that ability of the state to impose the charge is no more authority than they've already got.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hawker, for your questions. Any questions from Fairbanks? Do you guys want a car rental terminal up there?
Sure.
Okay.
You mean at the Don Young International Airport?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Richard.
And I thought about actually that question because the way this title is sculpted, it would prohibit Fairbanks or Juneau or anybody else because it's not a state-owned facility. So you couldn't dump it in.
Fairbanks is state owned.
State Fairbanks. Well, you go. She's
you were some giant of the Anchorage Airports, I recall.
There you go. Yeah.
Any questions for Mr. Pepper? Okay. Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Pepper. Let's see. Mr. Steiner, are you online or?
He's walking around the halls. He's a school board member.
Yeah. Okay. Is he online? Is he in the audience? John Steiner, was he supposed to be here, John? Okay. I have him on the list, so that's fine. Okay. I don't see any other anyone else here to testify, so we'll go ahead and close the public testimony on House Bill 115. Is there still some more questions for the sponsor, for Mr. Pepper, the developer? Okay. Well, if we don't have any questions, Representative Foster, and
just kidding.
Go ahead, Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, this cleanup that is supposed to occur, I didn't hear where that was going to occur when we discussed it. Is there a reason that we're going to report it out without that having been cleaned up?
Mr. Pepper, Josh? I guess I'm unclear, too, as to where the cleanup needs to be done. Maybe you can help us.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman and Representative Kelly, the bond insurers and the bond underwriters are working daily to work out the language to get authority the way they like it so that they can get the best rate they want on the bonds. That language isn't quite complete yet. As the bond attorneys work on that language, we've run it through the airport's attorney, which is the Assistant Attorney General, John Steiner. And Mr. Steiner has some stylistic changes, so it's this attorney says it one way, this attorney says it another way. And at the House Transportation Committee, Mr. Steiner testified that he wanted to take one more pass at the stylistic changes, and he would be drafting those. That was last week. It's my understanding we've asked on the Senate side at the Senate Transportation Committee if we could submit those changes at that point so that it'd be dealt with the Transportation Committee since it's substantive to what their committee deals with. But Mr. Steiner at the House Transportation Committee testified that he didn't see any substantive changes, again, stylistic language. So that's the current plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any members okay with that? Representative Stoltz?
No, Mr. Chairman. I like to say Senate as many times as I can because Norm isn't sitting here. Chairman also represents my airport. I think there's going to be a thorough look at this, and my concern. So I have a comfort level that, not that anybody cares, but I'm comfortable.
Works for us.
Works for you. Works for Fairbanks. All right. It must be good then. All right. No other questions. Thank you for your testimony. Committee members, you want to do this one, Representative?
Well, I'd be happy to, but Representative Foster's return.
Go ahead. Representative Hawker, go ahead. We need a backup in case Representative Foster is ill or sick.
I'd like to move House Bill 115, Transportation, out of committee with individual recommendations. And I see on this one, I think we have a nothing, no fiscal amendments.
Zero fiscal note. Zero fiscal note.
And a zero fiscal note.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Very good. Any objections? Say none. The bill passes committee.
That's what I'm looking for.
All right.
What are we doing tomorrow, Mr. Chairman?
Are you gone tomorrow?
No, I'll be here.
We have a Senate Bill 62, Appropriation Division of Elections. I believe you have an amendment that you passed in. Good time.
Way ahead of time.
Way ahead of time, yes, sir. Okay, and then Senate Bill 56, the Criminal Law Procedures Sentencing. That sounds like a judiciary bill. Must be a fiscal note with that. And so those two bills, both of those could take quite a while.
That's a Blakely one.
Maybe, probably. And then, yeah, so we have nothing for Wednesday, so if those bills need to carry over, we can do that on Wednesday. Thursday, we have two meetings scheduled. Joint House Senate Finance Committee overview with Alaska Permit Fund Corporation. And that's over in the Senate room, Senate Finance, 10 to 11. And then that afternoon, we have the two education bills scheduled. So we'll probably go ahead and take public testimony on those. I'm not sure what we'll do with those yet. Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Yes. Representative Wire, go ahead.
The sentencing bill is to comport with a U.S. Supreme Court case on sentencing guidelines and discretion by judges. And it went through judiciary, but no one here is on judiciary. So I'm curious how that's going to affect sentencing and the cost and corrections and the judicial system. I mean, so there's a blend of both policy, judicial implications, and financial ones. So it may seem like nitpick or in the judiciary vein, but I hope I get some latitude on some of it, because I talked with the Department of Law representatives today and the sponsors' staff today about it, and I have a number of concerns.
Sure. No, I understand, Representative Wyrick, and you're certainly right. You almost have to go in the judiciary to figure out what the cost is to the state. So.
And I'm not, I don't want to debate, well, maybe I do debate some of the policy implications, sure. but there's going to be a cost.
Sure. No, that's reasonable. It's just that if you do know of some amendments or changes you want to make ahead.
I'll try and get them in as soon as possible.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Representative Hopper. And
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask an indulgence if your staff could. I'm expecting some of these amendments to be, worthy of a substantial amount of debate, and if it's at all possible, if we could get a copy of that, perhaps, you know, as expeditiously as possible to study the amendments in advance.
Yes.
Would be very helpful. Not ask that of standard procedure, which most here is fine most of the time, but this is one I'd sure like to have a heads up on.
I understand. As of right now, I don't know if we have any amendments yet.
On the elections bill?
No.
No, we have
on the crime bill.
Representative Cross on the election, but the crime bill, we don't have any yet. Go ahead, Representative Cross.
Well, yeah, I mean, I met today as well with the staff, with Susan Parks from the Department of Law and with staff from Senator Terrio's office, and I mean, I don't know whether I have amendments or not. It's such a big... we were going over the concepts, trying to understand whether it's increasing or not, how the aggravators could work, the appeals section we were doing a lot of work on. But I understand you and Representative Hawker's need to get these, if there are any amendments in early. I'm just getting my head around sort of what it is, whether I agree, and if I disagree, what direction I'd like to take it. And it's difficult, but we'll try.
Sure, no, that's fine. And again... You know, if we have to hold over to incorporate some of these amendments or conceptual amendments, we will do that too. Yeah. Let's get rid of the rest of the boss. I'm with you on that one. Okay, anything else? All right, then we're adjourned until tomorrow.